Welcome to Short Hops. Derek Van Riper here, as always, with Bernie Pleskoff. And heavy slate on the agenda here as we look at the relief pitcher rankings. Also going to talk about the new commissioner, Rob Manfred, taking over. We didn't spend any time on that last week, so we're going to talk about some potential improvements there. Of course, we'll take a look around the league at some news and transactions as well. Bernie, how's it going today?
Everything's great. We have a beautiful day in Phoenix. Had a wonderful luncheon with our hot stove luncheon group. There were about 14 of us today. It was just terrific. We do something, you know, we talk about bold predictions. So we went around the room a couple of times. It was great. And have a couple more, and then the bell's going to ring for spring training. So it's getting close, Derek, but these last 2 weeks are the toughest. They really are. You know it's around the corner, and you want the days to fly by. Take every day as it comes. But this is a time when transactions slow down, too. So we just have to put up with two more weeks.
Yeah, a lot of minor signings at this point, although we're still waiting for James Shields to choose a new team. I would expect that's going to happen between the recording of today's episode and next week. If I had to estimate, it's probably coming here within the next week. But we shall see what happens. A handful of teams have been ruled out officially over the last, 12 hours or so. But no need to worry about that right now. We'll talk about it once he actually has a new team to pitch for.
I just want to weigh in that I think it's going to be the Padres or the Yankees. I think those are the teams that make the most sense for me. The Yankees need him desperately. For the Padres, he would be the icing on the cake. He's a California guy, big ballpark, less pressure, but not as great a chance to win a ring. I like the Yankees and Padres. Padres and Yankees, 1-2, 2-1, either way.
Yeah, I'm adamant that the Yankees are a better fit for a guy like Shields because the contract, even though it might not be as much as we once thought, still going to be pretty substantial. I think the Padres might be better off trying to make a deal for Cole Hamels, who signed, I think, more affordably than the contract that James Shields is likely to receive. Let's start off talking about the new commissioner because I don't want that topic to fall off for another week. Right. Rob Manfred taking over for Bud Selig. He's been on the job for a week, essentially, or a little more than a week now. Among the core issues he's looking at right now, there are a lot of conversations about pace of play and ways to speed up the game. I mean, the first question I have, Bernie, do you think it's necessary? Does the game need to be cut down? Are games actually too long right now? Is this actually a real problem?
It is a real problem from this perspective, in my opinion. If you want to get young people involved in this game, like when I was a little kid, all there was baseball and there was not all the other stimuli. You are going to have to reduce the time of the game. And not by 2 minutes, by 10 minutes or 15 minutes. You have got to get these games under 3 hours. And for me, the way to do that is get the guy in the batter's box, get the pitcher to stop walking around the mound and praying and let him start pitching. You know, that I'm not saying necessary a pitch clock, but the umpire has to say, get it going to the guy standing outside the box and the guy roaming around. And those two things in itself will cut at least 5 minutes from the game.
I mean, there's already a rule in the rule book. It says when the bases are unoccupied, the pitcher shall deliver the ball to the batter within 12 seconds after he receives the ball. Each time the pitcher delays the game by violating this rule, the umpire shall call a ball. And it's rule 8.04 in the MLB rule book, and I don't think it's ever come up. I don't think I've ever seen that applied before, but it's in the book already. I think the only concern I would have is that, let's just say the average length of the game is over 3 hours, 3 hours and 8 minutes or 3 hours and 10 minutes, whatever it's at right now. Even if you get it back down to 2:55, which I think it was in 2010. 2 hours and 55 minutes. Does the extra 15 minutes you save really pull in a younger audience? I don't know if I buy into that. I think there are other issues. I think it's more about finding ways to get young people to enjoy playing the game and to grow up going to games. I don't think it's the amount of time the game takes that's keeping the demographics from building up at the younger side of the scale.
I don't disagree with that, but I think it's all of the above. I think every component that you can add to helping a young fan become a lifelong fan helps. And I think saying 2 hours and 50 minutes versus 3 hours and 6 minutes, it's the reason gas is $2.99 and not $3.01 or $3. $2.99 sounds better than $3. It's just perception. And in this case, I think perception is reality. And that's why I think, Derek, the things you mentioned are, you know, getting people to play more in some manner. And that might be, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it. But the time of the game is an issue, and they are getting longer and longer. And of course, television ads have a lot to do with that. Pitchers warming up have a lot to do with it. But this is a game without a clock, and I do not want to see a clock introduced.
Yeah, the pitch clock to me seems somewhat futile. And the other thing that I think is important to point out, and you brought it up, is advertising money is critically important to the game. I don't see many scenarios where any entity will pass up the opportunity to make more money. So if you shorten up the game, if you shorten up the time between innings, you're running fewer commercials on TV broadcasts, so you're losing out on revenue that way. So anything that's going to cost the league revenue is probably not really an option for making the game faster.
I think you're absolutely right. But how many times have we seen a guy get out of the box after every pitch and play with his gloves and his bat and knock the dirt out of his spikes, which isn't there? I mean, it just can go on so long. And that, just doing that, will really make things move.
Yeah, Ryan Braun, every single pitch, takes a step back, puts the bat down, leans the bat on his leg, adjusts each batting glove, picks up the bat, steps in slowly with one foot, has his hand up calling timeout, brings his hand down, brings the other foot in, slowly brings the bat around.
I mean, just nodded off.
And he's that's what he does. Like, I mean, that's what he does every single pitch. It's totally ridiculous. I mean, I think those are the little things you can change that will increase the pace of the game, but I don't think you can make wholesale changes. I just don't think that's going to happen just because of the advertising elements that are in play. I mean, is there anything else you can think of that would be worth looking at, aside from the pitch clock, which is something that, even though we don't seem to like it, it's something that's being looked at in the upper levels of the minor leagues this year?
To me, the single greatest waste of time in a baseball game, and the thing that drives me up a wall more than anything, is keeping runners close at first base and throwing over. That's not going to change. It's part of the game. You can't limit the pitcher and say you're going to have two throws over. It's just not going to happen. That's the integrity of the game. But if you look and you watch the crowd and you listen to an away crowd, the boos rain down when a pitcher throws the ball over to first base to keep a runner on. Now, if that were to change, that's where the real time waste takes place. And by the way, that also adds a lot of throws onto a pitcher's arm. But that's not going to change. That's the integrity of the game. You're not going to reduce it to three balls and two strikes. That's not going to happen. So I think the only way to do it is to make the players move more quickly when the game is in play.
Yeah, that's pretty much the only way to do it without cutting out time between innings, which I think is the last thing we would ever see. Other priorities for the new commissioner, though, beyond pace of play. I'm not that worried about pace of play. I wouldn't mind if the games were 10 or 15 minutes shorter, but I'm going to watch them anyway. I'm not the guy that the league is worrying about. But what else is a priority for the new commissioner?
The greatest priority, in my opinion, without a doubt, is what to do with Tampa Bay and Oakland. The other commissioner did a fantastic job. I think Commissioner Selig really changed the game. But the issue of Tampa Bay and Oakland have been deferred long enough. Ultimately, I think we could see the Montreal Rays. You know, it's possible. But what do you do with a franchise that really has no way? They've been good and they can't sell tickets. If you live on one side of the bay, it's very tough to get over the bridge and into your seat in time for the game, because the traffic is just there's one way in from the other side of the bay, and it's too tough to do. I think it was a bad park to begin with. It's a tough situation. This commissioner, I think, will find a way out of it. And that may mean that this club will leave the Tampa Bay area and go somewhere else. And it could very well be Mexico or it could very well be Montreal. But as I was reminded today, Montreal doesn't have a stadium ready, but ultimately it could happen.
Yeah, I hope Montreal gets baseball back at some point. I always thought Vancouver, because of its size, would be a good option, but it's pretty close to Seattle in terms of markets, so you don't ever really hear Vancouver come up. But I think you could look at a lot of different possibilities. Havana gets tossed out there as a possibility at some point.
I thought that about 5 years ago, that I thought baseball would go to Cuba. In fact, I talked to Roland Heeman about it, that if we ever naturalized relations with Cuba, that ultimately they would have a baseball team. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but down the road, you have to look at that.
Yeah, that's probably like 20 to 30 years down the road as opposed to 5 to 10, but I think it's definitely a long-term possibility. For me, the biggest priority, if I'm the commissioner, is cleaning up the blackout rules. And one way that this is beneficial is I think you can connect with some of those younger fans if you remove the blackout rules from all the mobile devices. For example, if I buy the MLB TV package, not the extra innings package on satellite, but the one for the computer or for the tablet, I can't watch the in-market team. I can't watch the Brewers if I'm sitting here in Madison, Wisconsin, trying to watch the game on my tablet because the local TV operator, in this case, or the TV network is Fox Sports Wisconsin, they have exclusive rights, so the game gets blacked out of my tablet. But what I think you're going to find, as many studies have shown, younger people, millennials in particular, do not like to pay for cable. Cable TV is something that younger people just choose not to buy. They try to stream their content online. They try to buy things a la carte. And if you can't watch your favorite team in market, you're going to either choose not to watch them at all or you're going to find some other means to do it. And I think it's a simple solution. I just think put some advertising into those games. When you watch games on MLB TV, there are a lot fewer ads being served up in between innings than there are during a game on television. When you watch the game on TV, there's ads, of course, back to back to back. But you watch it on your tablet, you might see one or two ads, and then you get just the logo. This game is at commercial break, back momentarily. I mean, if you monetize that correctly, you can remove those blackout restrictions and connect with younger fans.
And I do think that's something that will change, and I think it is a priority of his, and I think that's a great thing. Right now in Major League Baseball, there are some franchises with very, very sticky TV litigation going on. The Dodgers, for one. I believe the Astros still have an issue. So there are issues with broadcast rights that have really thrown a curveball to some major ball clubs, and those have to be resolved.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, that we've saw it. Houston, I think, was the best example of that last year. A lot of people in the Houston area, if they didn't have the right cable provider, could not watch the Astros. It just wasn't even an option. There was no tier of sports programming they could buy to even see their local team. The other issue with the blackouts, too, is you have certain parts of the country that are parts of multiple teams' territories. For example, if you lived in Las Vegas and were trying to watch a game, you might have the A's, the Giants, the Dodgers, the Angels, the Diamondbacks. You might have a long list of teams that are blacked out in certain parts of the country. And I think you just want as many people to be available to watch every team as possible. I think that's the ultimate goal. I mean, you have not only fantasy owners, but you just have fans of all different teams living in all different places, and geography shouldn't be a barrier that keeps people from enjoying the game. But that just seems like the kind of archaic rule that you would really want to try to get rid of. But it does seem like something that is a priority, at least on the digital platforms, but hopefully even on TV here as well. Anything else you have in mind, though, for the new commissioner, Bernie?
I would like to see us finally, once and for all, look at the DH and have the same rules apply to both leagues. But you know what? I think that's on a back burner still. I don't think that's on a front burner. And as we always remind ourselves, it's very difficult. It's very different, let me put it that way, to put together a National League roster than it is an American League roster. So, A, if you're going to transition into the DH, the games in the National League will last longer. You've got another hitter at the plate. You don't have three pitch strikeouts like you do with when some pitchers hit. So you're defeating the purpose of shortening the game. However, what you are doing is unifying the game to one set of rules. And those set of rules, I don't think that set of rules will be without the DH. I think if there's any change, it would be both leagues would use the DH. But I don't see that happening anytime soon.
What if you had a rule where you could only use three different pitchers in the game through nine innings? For every two extra innings that are played, you could bring in one additional pitcher. What if you just cut down the number of pitching changes?
I think that changes the integrity of the game. I think you've got left-handed specialists, right-handed specialists. I think it will add more offense, which is another objective. And I don't think eliminating shifts is going to help either. That's the integrity of the game. That's the genius of management. So I don't think any of those rules will ever get by the Players Association. And let's make something very clear. Any rule of the game cannot be dictated solely by a commissioner or by the vote of the owners. The players are equal partners in this, and they really have a say on every rule change that takes place. I don't think you're going to get any rule change that lessens the availability of players for the game or changes that structure. It will change. They would approve, I think, adding a DH in the National League because that will add more jobs.
Exactly. You have more veteran players who can hang around, who can still hit, but maybe can't field. I think that's the kind of thing they could do. Also think that whatever extra time you get from longer at-bats of not having pitchers hit in the National League, you probably remove some of the extra pitching changes and switches and things that happen that can take a little bit longer. So,
right.
I don't know. I think it probably comes out in the wash. I'm fine with DH in both leagues makes more sense to me. If they were to eliminate the DH from the AL, which I don't think they would do, I just want the leagues to play by the same rules. I just want the AL and NL rules to be the same. I'm not even that picky about which side ends up winning.
I agree with you. I don't like seeing two different games, especially at the World Series. I think it's really a shame that it's two different games, but they are. It's night and day, apples and oranges. The two leagues do not play the same ball game. And the same happens during interleague play during the season. It's not fair to either side. You know, you've got a guy like Big Poppy. You want to see him play defense? You want the Red Sox to go in and not play Big Poppy? You do if you're the rest of the East, but not if you're a Red Sox fan. You know, it's very tough. And I think it's something that has to be resolved, but I don't think it's on the front burner.
I also don't want my pitcher straining his quad or his hamstring or his oblique, running the bases or swinging the bat when there's so little value from so many of those players offensively. Like, to me, this is about maximizing the assets. I'm the Players Association. I want my players to be as healthy as possible so my veteran players coming back into free agency can get as many maxed out contracts as possible. Like, that to me is something that I definitely want to see as far as if I'm a player, I want to be protected in that way. Aside from creating more jobs, you're keeping your pitchers healthy. And that's important when it seems like even though pitching has been very strong over the last 4 or 5 years in particular, the game has become more pitcher-friendly. I like that. I think that's a good thing. I want to protect the game's best arms.
I agree with you, Derek. And I do think the amazing thing to me, and something I have never understood and I will not understand, take a look at pitchers and where they came from. Many of them were outfielders and infielders prior to pitching. Many of them pitched in high school but played six positions or played the outfield and pitched in college, and all of a sudden they forgot how to hit. That blows my mind. I don't get it. Or maybe it's just that the fastballs are faster, the curveballs break more, and maybe that's why they're so bad. But boy, universally, pitchers just give up when they go to the plate. Not all. There are some, but I've seen some very bad hitting pitchers, and I've looked them up. And they hit well in high school or college. It's something I never understood.
Yeah, big jump in talent. I think it's one of those things, if you're not putting in as much time as other players do, as hitters would, I think that's going to put you at a pretty big disadvantage in terms of trying to keep up. But let's move on to some transactions and some news-related items. We'll get to our relief pitcher rankings here a bit later on. I want to start with Josh Hamilton, Bernie. He's going to miss 6 to 8 weeks following surgery on Wednesday to repair the AC joint in his right shoulder. That puts him kind of in this doubtful to almost certainly out label for opening day. It probably knocks him out for a couple of weeks in the regular season because he's going to need some time at extended spring training or on a minor league rehab assignment to get his timing back down. It raises questions about the type of player he is once he's healthy. Is he going to have the typical power when he comes back? He really hasn't had typical power for a couple of years in Anaheim anyway, compared to what he was doing in Texas. But what do you think the Angels are going to do here in the short term? What are your expectations for Hamilton once he does get back on the field?
Number one, I think this gives more at-bats to C.J. Cron one way or the other. I think he now gets a more stabilized position. I think they're an outfielder short that they have to go find somewhere, because I'm not sure Hamilton, once he gets back, will stay. There's another injury waiting to happen. And this is the peril of long-term contracts. This is why, if I were a general manager, there would be a max that I would have in my head, and once that player went over that max in negotiations, I'm out. And I think that's what happened to James Shields. I think James Shields may have wanted 5 years. Well, I don't know a team out there that's going to give that guy 5 years, but he held out, and here we are, 2 weeks away from spring training. He's not on a ball club. And I think it could be a one-year Santana-type deal or a Kyle Loesch-type deal at a reduced rate, maybe 2 years. You know, so that's what happened with Hamilton. You signed him for a long period of time. He produced and got hurt in Texas. You bring him in right after you bring in Albert Pujols, and what happens? Hamilton goes into the tank. His first year, he couldn't hit a lick in the first half, started to hit in the second half, and he's been hurt every year since.
Yeah, I mean, with Hamilton, of course, the story is well known. He's 33 now. He'll be 34 in May. The amount of wear and tear in his body is disproportionate to his actual age. I mean, it's hard to know just how he would have held up anyway in the long run. And this is just the latest in a long list of injuries that he's dealt with over the course of his time in the big leagues. But just not the player we grew accustomed to seeing over the course of his years in Texas. I'm with you, though. I think Cron gets the big bump in the short term because Matt Joyce will platoon with Colin Cowgill in Hamilton's spot, and Cron will be the primary DH.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about Hamilton that really concerns me is selectivity and pitch recognition just are not there. If you start a sequence with him with a breaking ball and off-speed pitch and never let him see a fastball and keep the ball away from the center of the plate, he's going to go up there hacking. So I don't know if it's a lack of confidence or if it's a lack of selectivity or he thinks he can hit breaking balls. It's just not the same guy we saw for a year or two in Texas. And let's be fair about this. We're not talking about somebody that had a big, long year after year after year being a great hitter. He had a couple good years.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he peaked kind of I don't know. I mean, he did have some massive years, and some of the seasons he put together were marred by injuries, so we don't really know how many healthy games he played when the performance dipped. But you mean, you look at what he did. 2008 was his first year with Texas. He hit .304, stole 9 bases, hit 32 home runs, and drove in 130. The next year in Texas, he only played 89 games, only hit 10 home runs, 741 OPS health. I mean, he played half a season. And how many of the games that he did play was he healthy for? I think that's a fair question. Bounce back the next year. 32 home runs again, 100 runs driven in, .359 batting average, 8 steals in 2010. Lost another 12 games from that total in 2011. Production slipped a little bit, .298, 25 homers, 94 runs driven in, still stole bases, 8 stolen bases, 43 home runs in 2012. Like, I think he was a lot more good than bad, but it was feast or famine in some of those cases. Even in that big year in 2012, I'm pretty sure that was a pretty ugly first half, second half split.
Yeah, you make a good point. 5 years. So there's 5 very solid years, more than I had given him credit for. But I think when he left Texas, he has never lived up to the expectations they had in Anaheim. It's a sad story. It really is.
A lot of risk, of course, for the reasons we mentioned. But I believe he's now 3 years into that 5-year, $125 million contract that he signed with the Angels prior to the 2013 season. Looking at a key free agent here, Bernie, and you mentioned it when we were talking about the new commissioner. Clearly, things are changing as far as the relationship between the United States and Cuba, and it's going to have a pretty big impact on Major League Baseball. We have another influx of talent sort of waiting in the wings in free agency, and if you've been tracking it at all, more or less, just the way players can become available to big league teams is changing. Yoan Moncada is a free agent. He's a 19-year-old switch-hitting third baseman by many accounts. I've seen him listed as a shortstop some places, but he's had private workouts with several teams. I've seen as many as a dozen teams linked to him as possible suitors. I mean, this guy, from the reports I have read, seems to have a ceiling that's higher than any of the Cuban players that have come over so far this decade.
Same thing I've heard, and I've also heard, and we had our luncheon today with a lot of people involved in baseball. This is a guy that's going to cost some team a penalty for going over their international signing money, but they're worth, you know, it's worth paying for. So that, to me, reduces the number of teams in play. There are teams that need a third baseman or even a shortstop that can pay the price. Of course, you know, the Yankees come to mind, even though Headley's there, but they will always be in the hunt for, you know, good players. But there are other teams for sure. And to me, it's the Dodgers. This says Dodgers all the way, because if any team needs a third baseman right now, I think it's the Dodgers.
Yeah, the Dodgers could definitely become the front runners there, have the need, have had the pipeline with Cuban players, of course, with Yasiel Puig and Alex Guerrero already being signed in the last couple of years. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if Moncada follows suit and ends up in Dodger blue at some point, but tons of teams interested, and for good reason. I mean, if you talk about players that could make an impact for decades, I mean, this is the type of guy that Yoan Moncada is supposed to be. So we'll see. I would think before the start of spring training, he may have a team now that he is cleared to sign. And I know Hector Oliveira and Andy Ibañez are a couple players, too, that may not be far behind him to sign with new clubs here in the coming weeks. But I want to talk about some other signings and news items that have gone down. We found out today Ryan Ludwig has signed a minor league deal with the Rangers. It's been a couple of seasons since Ludwig has really hit consistently. His injuries have been a part of the issues the Reds have had in left field really for the last couple of years. Is there anything left in the tank? I mean, I think the concern I have with Ludwig is that he doesn't really fit into a platoon with the guys they already have. Ryan Rua, Michael Choice, also right-handed hitters, so it's not as though you can mix and match and use him as part of a platoon. He'd be on the small side just like the other guys they have.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I'm not sure he's a major league player anymore. Clearly not an everyday guy. And if you can't hit regularly in Cincinnati, what does that say? Simply because that's a great hitter's ballpark. And he just, you know, I think it's a stretch to think he's going to make the club.
Yeah, I don't think it's guaranteed at this point. Of course, he's on a minor league deal with an invitation to spring training. If he makes the roster, Ludwig will get a one-year, $1.75 million contract, so really not a lot invested in him. Even if he makes the opening day roster and struggles, he's no guarantee to stick around all year. So
I want to explain minor league deals from a scout's perspective and what happens in these minor league deals and why you see so many of them. There's two reasons, three reasons, actually, for all of these 10, 12, 15 guys signing minor league deals. Number one, a club may have very good relationship with an agent, and that club knows that agent has players coming in the pipeline, and they may want to bid on them. So the agent goes to them and says, hey, would you give Joe Doakes an opportunity with a minor league deal? And the answer is yes, because I want to keep my good relationship with you, and I, you know, maybe I'll find lightning in a bottle. So yes. Number two is that club can now expose this minor league player to every other club and maybe be able to deal him off during the year or right after spring training. If the guy doesn't make the club, he goes down and plays AAA in most cases. And now I've got a chip to deal with. And the third reason is I need depth on my minor league roster. You know, if we're talking AAA and AA, those are not always prospects. AAA and AA are roster fillers that can be on your roster and come up during the season. If your left fielder gets hurt, well, we'll go get Ryan Ludwig. So that's a very crucial reason. And number four, and clearly the easiest of it all, is that during spring training, they want their veterans not to play every day. They don't want to play their prospects every day. So now they've got some depth to play in spring training games to take the long road trips and expose these minor league signings to the other 29 teams. So lots of reasons to sign minor league players. And the biggest reason of them all is maybe you're going to catch lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, a lot of times you're going to find teams that are just hoping to get that spark at a position of dire need. I mean, with Diamondback signed Gerald Laird, for example, that's not a good example of a guy that's ever really hit a ton, but it's usually the Rockies and John Axford's another one that went down recently. If Axford somehow can figure out how to pitch in Colorado, maybe they have a guy that can close for them at pennies on the dollar. I mean, that's what teams are trying to do. It's sort of the what if something goes right scenario without having a lot of risk involved in giving a player a guaranteed contract, but tons of good reasons there, as you mentioned. A couple other signings that have gone down, at least one more I want to get to. Carlos Villanueva signed with the Cardinals, and this time last year, it was Pat Neshek getting that minor league deal with the spring training invite, which leads me to think that Carlos Villanueva, as a guy that's flashed some talent before, will somehow put all the pieces together for the Cardinals, because that is exactly what the Cardinals do year in and year out.
Low risk, high reward, that's the Cardinals. This has Cardinals written all over. You're going to see this guy pitch in the big league club. I really believe it. You hit it on the head. They know how to take pitching and make it good pitching.
Yeah, he'll end up pitching the seventh inning for them, and he'll be really good all year. Like, that's put it in the bank, because that's just how their coaching staff, that's how they're scouting, that's how they work. That's why they're the Cardinals, for lack of a better description. I got a few other news items that caught my eye that I wanted to pass along. Bernie, I want to get your thoughts on these here as well. Billy Hamilton has been working this offseason with Delino DeShields. Now, I think DeShields is currently the AAA manager for the Reds at Louisville, but previously, DeShields worked with Hamilton as a minor league manager earlier in his career. Together this offseason, Hamilton has been working on his strength and conditioning, trying to bunt more consistently. The emphasis from the Reds is also to square up the ball for more line drives, and that kind of goes without saying. But when you look at where Hamilton's going in drafts right now, his ADP is about 45th overall. It's a late third-round pick in a 15-team mixed league. Are you willing to buy into Billy Hamilton at that price under the idea that he could still become a better hitter or just a better offensive player with improved plate discipline, improved bunting ability, or whatever that development might be?
I'm not sure. I think that's still too high for him, because you're not getting a lot of power. There are some gap doubles in him. He is slight of frame. Every time you look at him, you're not looking at a muscular guy. You're looking at a sprinter. You're looking at an athlete that has very, very good first step quickness and great agility, good instincts. That's who he is. He's a runner, and he can chase down fly balls after getting a bad jump, for example. He is a very good ball player. Is he the 46th best player? Well, I think there's steals to be had elsewhere from guys that might be able to get on base even more. But, you know, those steals are very, very attractive. I just don't know what else is in his game. Given that the Reds are not going to score a ton of runs, I don't know how many runs there are for him to score. So I think that's too high for me. What about you?
I think it's a matter of how you're building your roster, but I don't think in a snake draft like that, especially in a high stakes like the NFBC, I don't think I want Hamilton on my roster in a league like that, because I'm trying to get half of my steals from one player. And I just worry if he gets hurt, what's going to happen? I mean, where are my steals going to come from? Whereas if I'm in an auction league where I can control things a little more, maybe pay a little less than the equivalent of a late third round pick for him, if I can be a little closer to what I think his actual value is in terms of cost, I'm more inclined to own him in a format like that. But the more shallow the league, the more willing I am to buy in on Hamilton. I do think there's a possibility he gets a little better as a hitter. At the very least, he might just become a more efficient base stealer. I mean, look how often he was caught last year. I think he was caught like 23 times or something.
Way too much.
I mean, they gave him the green light 75, 80 times last year. Very few players get that many chances to run. If he doesn't convert more opportunities, that number will slowly start to go down. But even with a low OBP, below 300 OBP, he had that many opportunities. So if he can bunt a little bit more consistently for hits, if he can show some improvement in plate discipline, not even a lot, just some. If you get that OBP in the 310, 315 range, I mean, every time he gets on first, he's an immediate threat to put himself on second. Suddenly you have a guy that becomes that exciting catalyst again and a player that the Reds look at and say, yeah, we definitely want this guy atop our lineup, even though the OBP is lower than a typical leadoff guy. He's always on second base. He's not just getting on first.
But see, I think you can do the same thing with a Jerod Dyson and pay half the price, if that. Dyson is going to play in a lot of games as a pinch runner late in the game, and he's only in there to run. So he may not get the hits and the RBIs for you, but he's going to score some runs. He's going to steal some bases. And I can even drill down further to Raymond Fuentes, who, if he makes the club, is going to be in there as a pinch runner. And if he's in there, he's going to be in there to steal. And let's say he's in 40 games a year and tries to steal 40 times and makes it 30 times. Now you've got 30 stolen bases and you paid 10 cents on the dollar. That's what I'm more inclined to do, if possible, than to spend a number 46 on a guy that I'm not as sure of, especially if they penalize me for caught stealing.
Yeah, a lot of leagues I play in don't have that, but there are definitely some leagues out there that do, and I think that would hurt Hamilton quite a bit, since outside of runs and steals, he's probably not going to help you in the other categories.
Exactly.
Let's move on to Justin Verlander. He came up in passing last week, and he didn't make our top 25 starting pitcher rankings. And the thing that I think it's easy to lose sight of is that last year, Verlander was coming back from surgery to repair a tear in his core. So he had core muscle repair surgery last offseason. His throwing program was off from where it normally would be. Schedule-wise, he's been on a completely normal offseason schedule this year. He's been able to add strength because he hasn't had any sort of lifting restrictions. I have to wonder if maybe, even if he's not a top 25 starting pitcher anymore, if there is still a rebound coming from Verlander. I mean, do you see him getting back to his 2013 form this year, or possibly even something a little bit better than that?
I'm going to see a lot of the Tigers in spring training. I think I'm seeing them four times. I'm hoping that I get to see, you know, a lot of their rotation starters. There may be two starters per game at some point. It's happened before. I doubt it, but let's say I see four of their starters. I'm hoping one of them will be Verlander for three innings. But I want to see is this. I want to see if the velocity is anywhere close to what it was, and if the velocity changes in inning three versus inning one. I want to see how easy he is throwing, and if, in fact, he is compensating in any way and has changed his landing spot or his release point. You know, when it's all said and done, I don't think it's the same guy, core injury or lack of core injury. I think what it is at this point is the number of innings have caught up with him. And I think age is catching up with him. He's a good pitcher now. He's just not a great pitcher. He's still, knowing that he had that injury, which I did when I did my rankings, he still didn't make my top 40.
Yeah, I think that's as high as I could see him going in most rankings, is top 40 among starting pitchers. But even for me, I don't think he's going to quite get up to that point. I do see some rebound potential, but not enough to where I feel like I'm going to own Verlander across the board in 2015. We got some good news on Garrett Richards, Bernie. I know he was also kind of on the outside looking in, at least on my list last week, partially because we just don't know when exactly he's going to get back on the mound coming off that gruesome knee injury he suffered at the end of last season. The Angels are saying now that he might be able to return in April. So if you get Garrett Richards back, even by the end of April, how much are you willing to upgrade him on your rankings?
I had him pretty high, if I remember correctly. I don't have my rankings in front of me, but I had him pretty high. And that's because I do think he's coming back. And I do like everything about him. I like the who he's pitching for. I like where he's pitching. I do think he's a good rebound candidate that will work hard. Richards is a guy that I definitely have. I think he probably is in my top 30 or in my top 20 even. I don't remember it. But let me just say this. There's 250 starting pitchers in baseball, more than that. When you think that clubs go through 8 and 9 starting pitchers, some of them 10 starting pitchers a season, when you're a top 40 pitcher, you're pretty darn good. And this guy is really good. So I think if he's 90% of what he was, which I think we can expect, I really do, not 100%, but if he's 90%, that's a pretty darn good pitcher that, for me, has to be pretty high in my rankings.
I think for me, he's still on the outside looking at the top 20 because I'm just not convinced that that timetable, even pushed up, is something that he's a lock to make. I always think that knee injuries can be tricky when it comes to knowing just exactly how long a pitcher's going to need to get back on the mound and be their usual self, repeating mechanics and just getting deep into games. I want to talk about Mike Fulton-Nevich, Bernie. He is the inside track to the fifth starter job in Atlanta. I know he was a guy that you saw, I want to say, last spring when he was with the Astros, and he stood out to you. But what's your expectation for him in 2015 if he opens the year and is able to hold that job as the Braves' fifth starter?
We just talked about him today at lunch, and he's a guy I brought up again. And I'll tell you this, there was a major league executive there sitting right to my side, and I will not name him, but he agreed with me totally. He thinks this is an under-the-radar guy who is an extremely good pitcher, was shocked that the Astros traded him. And for me, it's with the wrong offensive club. I would like to have seen him get more run support than I think he'll get in Atlanta. But again, I say that not this year and maybe not next year. This is a star in the making. I think he's going to be a serviceable number five. They're going to have to watch his innings. He's a good pitcher now. He's going to be in a keeper league. This is a guy I would go and grab because he is going to be a very good starting pitcher. And I know a lot of baseball clubs who had him very high on their list.
Yeah, about 121 innings thrown between the big leagues and AAA last year for Mike Fulton-Nevich, an ERA over 5 at both stops, AAA Oklahoma City and in Houston. I actually thought there was a chance that he might be moved into the bullpen because he could be completely dominant out of the pen, but the control is the big issue, right? You look at the walks, that's been the major problem for him to this point in his career. Is he one of those guys, though, where the stuff is just so good, that he gets so much movement that he just has a difficult time locating?
He's one of the guys that you have to be patient with. He's a guy you say, look at this stuff, look at this arm, and wait. You have to say to yourself, he's got to be more around the plate. He's got to throw strike one more consistently. But the ball is moving so great. Once he realizes what's in that arm and the arm action matches what the stuff is and he starts throwing strikes, he won't stop. But it takes so much time to get that down because every pitch you have to think it through for a while. It doesn't become mechanical and automatic until you've thrown hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pitches at that arm angle and at that release point. But once you're there, you put it much more on automatic pilot. That takes a lot of innings. This guy clearly has star written all over him, but not quite yet.
Yeah, Mike Fulton-Nevich, maybe not the guy you want to target in your redraft league, but in those dynasty formats, those keeper formats, one to acquire now before the value starts to go up. One more pitcher I want to talk about related to recent news. The Padres revealed that Corey Lupke could be ready for the start of spring training. Lupke had Tommy John surgery last February. It's his second career Tommy John surgery, so I'm a little bit surprised that he'd be on track to be ready. This is a guy that pitched really well before elbow injuries have caught up to him. I wonder, is there any chance that maybe by May or June we could see him back in that San Diego rotation and pretty effectively chewing up innings again?
He was a top prospect for me before he went out the second time. Let me just be very clear that I do not think he's ready by spring training. That's for one, because it's not even a year, and it's a second time. So I don't think he's ready by spring training. I don't see May. I don't see June. This is a guy you're going to have to handle with very kid gloves because he's got that good of an arm and that bright a future if everything comes back. Some pitchers come back and their velocity improves. Some pitchers come back, they can't find their release point. Their mechanics need a total rework. We don't know yet, but the only thing I think I know pretty much is that I don't see him ready for spring training. And if they put the ball in his hands in here in Phoenix in March, I think it's a mistake.
Yeah, I think it's going to be more of a delayed timetable than the early reports suggest, but definitely rooting for Corey Luebke to make it back. Short list of pitchers that have come back from two Tommy John surgeries and pitched well in the big leagues over a prolonged stretch, but hopefully we'll see him join that that small group here over the next few months. I want to talk relief pitcher rankings here, Bernie. Last week we talked about starting pitchers, and we went 25 deep plus some sleepers and some notable omissions from those lists, and we'll try to focus on the top 20 or so here. I know you wrote up, I think, a top 40 for MLB.com, and my top 20 is posted in the RotoWire blog, rotowire.com/blog, if anyone wants to check it out. It's from the Monday Round Tripper article. But let's start from the bottom of the list. Let's start at number 20, and for me, it's Hector Rondon. I mean, this guy pitched really well last season, Bernie. Finished with a 23-2 strikeout-to-walk ratio and 0.67 ERA over his final 2 months. I think the only real issue, the only reason he wasn't higher on my list, is that the Cubs have a lot of good arms behind him. They brought in Jason Mott, who's now another year from Tommy John surgery. They brought in, or they still have, Neil Ramirez and Pedro Strop, who should be quality late-inning arms too. But Rondon didn't show any real flaws skills-wise last year that would lead me to think he can't handle the job.
29 saves. And oh, by the way, DVR, where did he start his career?
Cleveland, right?
Ugh, makes me sick. Great arm. Should have been pitching today in Cleveland, but he isn't. He's pitching for the Cubs. 2.42 ERA last year, 1.06 whip, 29 saves. I had him ranked at 21. This is a very good pitcher and a lot under the radar. If you're looking at guys that are going to save games, A, the Cubs are going to be improved. B, he's going to have more opportunities to save them. And C, he's going to convert them. I like him a lot.
Yeah, I think there's plenty to like with Hector Rondon. Who did you have at 20 on your list, Bernie?
Neftali Feliz, 1.99 ERA, a 0.98 whip. And let me emphasize that. My issue with Feliz has always been his command, throwing strikes. Well, he did throw strikes, and my hat went off to him when I did these rankings. Only had 13 saves for a bad ball club. The ball club's going to be improved. He's going to have more opportunities. I do not think he loses the job. If he does, it goes to Tanner Shepherds. But my guy is Feliz. I think he's going to pitch very well.
Yeah, Feliz made my top 20. Yeah, I got him up at 16. But the concern I have is just strikeouts. Are those going to come back? And health, too. I mean, is he going to be able to hold up? He's had his share of injury issues over the last couple of years, too. For me, I've got Zach Britton at number 19, lower than most people. I just wonder if there's going to be more strikeouts there, and if there aren't, can he get by with that extreme ground ball heavy skill set? We talked about him on the XM show earlier today. I worry about him more than his elite ERA and whip from last year would make most people worry.
I understand that, and he doesn't strike guys out. But you give me those ground balls with a guy on first, and I've got a double play. I like Britton a lot. 0.90 whip, 37 saves, but the Orioles aren't as good. I have him as number 8. As I said on the radio today, he would have been higher had the Orioles done more. And if I think they're going to be in more games, I don't think so. I think they're going to be good, not great. Britton is my number 8. He's that good.
Who did you have at 19?
Trevor Rosenthal, who is a disaster waiting to happen, or a brilliant reliever. Another guy we talked about today at lunch. Here's a guy that can throw 100 miles an hour. If he can find the plate, he's a wipeout, lights-out closer. The problem is he can't find the plate. Too many bases on balls, but oh, by the way, he saved 45 games, so Trevor Rosenthal made it at number 19 for me, but I'm a little worried about him.
Yeah, I've got him at 18, so I think we're pretty similar in terms of what we expect from him. I just worry that either Carlos Martinez, if he's not in the rotation, or Jordan Walden could potentially take over that job if the walk rate doesn't come down from Rosenthal. The whip was really ugly last year. Who did you have at 18?
That would be Glenn Perkins with the Twins. Now, I know there's some issues with Perkins, but when he is on, he is very good. But when he's not 100% healthy, that's why he's only 18, because he's a very good pitcher. 34 saves, a 1.18 whip, nice, you know, nobody to threaten him for that job in Minnesota. They will win, you know, they will be in some games. They will have an opportunity to save some games, just not as many as other clubs. That's why he falls at 18.
I've actually got him quite a bit higher. I've got him up at 12. I think before the forearm issue came up last year, he was having an elite season in terms of the ratios. And it just seems like the Twins, if they were going to trade him before, if they were going to trade him, they would have done it by now. There's no reason why they would keep waiting and waiting to move that asset as they move through their rebuilding process. I'm pretty confident.
The forearm's an issue.
Yeah, I mean, the MRIs came back without any structural damage, but it is something to be mindful of for sure. And I think that's what holds his ranking down. But I think he's, as long as he's healthy, I think he's fine. I think he's a third-tier closer for me. Looking at number 17 now, I've got Fernando Rodney at 17. The walks are just too much for me to get over. Usually that walk rate's hovering above 3.5 per nine. Sometimes it's up even above 4. The aging curve with him, I just wonder that I think he might be the kind of guy that when he loses it really fast.
Yeah, you could be right. I may have overranked him at 6. I just love who he's pitching for, though. I can't get over the fact that the Mariners are going to be so good, I think. And he saved 48 ball games, DVR. So I like that. I do think there's risk involved. I'm not inviting people to get up on the bridge with me and jump, but I do think he's pretty solid in getting it done after he gives you a heart attack. But be prepared. There's a lot of pitches coming up and a lot of balls, so I still think he's going to have a good season. My number 17 hasn't signed a contract, and that's Francisco Rodriguez, and I don't get it. This guy pitched so well for the Brewers. And is it a coincidence that when he tailed off, they tailed off?
He's not on my top 20. And even if he had signed, he still wouldn't be. And the reason I'm very concerned with K-Rod is that he has to rely now on pinpoint control. Otherwise, he is very vulnerable to hard contact. If he ends up back in Milwaukee, it's the same problem that we saw last year. It's a hitter-friendly environment. You leave the ball up, it's going to leave the yard. I see a lot of risk with K-Rod this year, and to me it's just not that surprising that he's still floating around out there on the open market, even though last year he started the year, he was pitching really well. I mean, he was dominant for the first couple months of the season.
He was unbelievable. Yeah.
Unsustainably good. I mean, like that went without saying at the time. And when you look at the numbers, the peripherals are still good. 73 strikeouts against 18 walks, but 14 home runs in 68 innings. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, but he also had a 0.99 whip. So it wasn't all bad, but I took into account when I did my rankings that he isn't going back to a hitter-friendly park. He's not going to pitch in Milwaukee. I see him going to a bigger ballpark. I frankly thought he was going to end up in Seattle, you know, and pitch the eighth inning, but that hasn't happened. So I don't know where he's going.
K-Rod, to me, if he ends up getting a closer spot, that's like paying sticker for Addison Reed. Addison Reed didn't make my top 20, but Addison Reed has the same problem. I mean, he has pretty good peripherals, strikes out enough guys, doesn't throw as hard as their closers, but home runs are just the downfall of Addison Reed, and I think they're going to be the downfall of K-Rod at this stage of his career.
What about the Tigers for him, DVR? Would that be a good fit?
It's a bigger park, so it could work out. I mean, they seem like they timed the market on relievers as poorly as any team in the league. It is crazy. I mean, like, I didn't expect Joe Nathan to collapse like he did last year. I thought Nathan could figure it out and be a useful closer for them, a guy that had a high twos, low threes ERA and a good whip and wasn't even close to that.
So now if you add Rodriguez to that Tigers bullpen, doesn't it improve it markedly? I don't know what I'm missing here, but I think they could use him. You know, I think they're a late-inning guy away, and I don't know what Soria has left. He ranked 40th for me, and certainly Nathan isn't. You know, let them all get in there and fight it out. Who do you have at 16?
16 on my list ended up being Neftali Feliz. That's where I ended up placing him, a little higher than you had him. I think there's some decent competition there if he struggles, where you could have Sheppers or Kuji Fujikawa take over.
But
if Feliz starts missing bats again, he could push himself up and be a top 10 closer by the end of the season.
Yeah, I've got Benoit there, another guy that drives me nuts. But his whip was 0.77 with 11 saves. And I like, you know, I like where he's going. It's not bad.
I like Benoit a lot. I like Benoit a lot, too. He didn't quite make my list. He was the first guy off of it, actually, in terms of the top 20. If only because they could go to Kevin Quackenbush if they want to go that route. But I think Benoit gets the chance to open the year with that job. I've got Steve Cishek at 15. I think based on last year, he actually could be a little bit higher. Strikeout rate went up above 11.5 strikeouts per nine last season. The issue is that his batting average on balls in play spiked up. I don't think that's indicative of skills loss. I don't think he was giving up consistent hard contact or anything you have to worry about. I think there's a good chance Cishek actually pushes his way up closer to the top 10 as this season unfolds.
I have him at 9, and the reason I have him at 9 is because I think this guy is a really underrated pitcher, a really underrated closer on a much better Marlins team. All those things add up to me to a star in waiting, and we haven't talked about him. Baseball doesn't talk about him. I just think he's a really good closer and a guy I would target to close out games on my fantasy team.
Yeah, I could see him moving up here a little bit because for me, I've got – well, actually, who do you have at 15 then if you have Cishek at 9?
I have Drew Storen, the guy the Nationals don't want to love, but I want to love him. You know, you hit upon it this morning on the radio. So maybe it was Thorne who said that the Nationals just never really commit to Drew Storen. And my answer to that was they just have insurance policies behind them, which they need. But Storen's a darn good pitcher. He had a whip of 0.98 with 11 saves and a 1.12 ERA. Those numbers play for me as a closer. Plenty of chances. Great ballpark. I don't think they're taking the ball away from him anytime too soon.
No, I would have had Storen in my top 10 if they wouldn't assign Casey Jansen. I've got him at 13 just because I don't think there's as much leash there as there would have been otherwise. But if Jansen can return to form, return to his pre-2014 form, that is, I think there's a guy lurking in the wings who's done it before could replace him. That's the only reason why he fell out of the top 10 for me. At 14, I've got Aaron Sanchez. He could fall considerably if they decide to make Brett Cecil their closer, or if they were to sign a K-Rod or a Rafael Soriano, or to make a trade for a more established option. But I think Aaron Sanchez as a reliever profiles very favorably. The control issues went away last year. The ERA and the WHIP were completely outstanding. I know you're probably going to add at least a run or a run and a half to the near one ERA that he had last year, and that's fine. But I think this is a guy that really seemed to fit well in that bullpen role.
I have him on the bubble simply because I don't know what his role is yet. He could be the seventh inning guy. He could be the eighth inning guy. He could be the closer. My prediction is he's the closer by the end of the season. That's how good I think his arm is, and that's how well I think he repeats his delivery. It's the experience that he doesn't have yet on a contending team. That combination, lack of experience, contending team, says to me that I think Cecil probably gets the first shot. Loop is in the loop as well as Sanchez. So they have three potential closers. My guy at 14 is Koji Uehara. Had a terrible closing to his season last year, a great first half, and then he fell apart. What I don't get is why he fell apart. I didn't see enough of him. He had a 2.5 ERA for a closer. That's very high. 26 saves, a 0.92 whip. I think he comes all the way back or the Red Sox are in trouble.
Yeah, he turns 40 just before opening day, too, so you just wonder how long he can hold up and maybe he can bounce back. I've got him at 11, but he's tough rank for me, maybe the toughest rank of all the closers. As I mentioned, Drew Storen at 13, and I think as I look at Sanchez versus Cishek, I would probably, if I had to draft today, go ahead and put Cishek ahead of Sanchez and probably Feliz also. But I still think if Sanchez wins that job or is named the closer, he can fit into this tier. Who do you have at 13, Bernie?
That would be Cody Allen of the Indians. I got angry with him a couple times last year when I thought he was overworked. And towards the end of the season, he coughed up a couple saves. Not many, but in crucial games. I'm not sure that that won't really help him tremendously. That he had that experience last year. There is nobody around that's going to take the job from him, not even Brian Shaw. He starts the season as the closer, had a 2.07 ERA, which I didn't like. I thought he was giving up way too many hits, 1.06 whip, but he did have 24 saves. Number 13 on my list, but he could get better.
I've got Allen up at 8. I believe in what he did last year. I think the Indians are pretty locked in on using him as the guy. He had 91 strikeouts in 69 and two-thirds innings. Also had a 2.07 ERA, 1.06 whip. Those ratios were pretty much elite, so I think he belongs up in the top 10. As I mentioned earlier, Glenn Perkins at 12 on my list. Who did you have at 12?
Houston Street, who I think really helped save the Angels. Now they have a stabilized closer. They can turn to him with confidence. He's got a great ERA of 1.37, a 0.94 whip, and 41 saves. I may have him way too low at 12. This is a very good pitcher. Age is creeping up a little bit, but I really like what he brings to the Angels.
Yeah, I like Street quite a bit too. I've got him at 10, so I think we both really like what he brings. Injuries have been the issue throughout his career, but his ERA and whip are as good as anybody's. He's still going to be close to a strikeout per inning. If he can avoid the DL this year, I think he's going to be a nice source of profit because he falls kind of into that second or third tier in many of the drafts that I've seen. I mentioned having Koji Uehara at 11. Who did you have up at 11?
I've got Jonathan Papelbon there because I don't think he'll be pitching for the Phillies. And he threw to a 2.4 ERA and a 0.91 whip with 39 saves for a very bad ball club. If he stays with the Phillies, they're just as bad, maybe even worse this year. When you can eke out 39 saves, that means you're pretty darn good. And Papelbon is pretty darn good. And I'd like to see, for his sake, Giles get the closing job and Papelbon be moved.
Yeah, I think that's a definite possibility. And you're going to see Kent Giles get targeted in a lot of leagues this spring. Moving up to number 10, I had Houston Street in that spot. Who did you have at 10?
Mark Melancon is 10 for the Pirates. Another good pitcher who really helped them, a 1.90 ERA, a 0.87 whip, and 33 saves. The chances will be there again. I think he's healthy. I think he's strong. The guy to watch out for there is Holtzcombe. We talked about him today at lunch. He's a guy that I saw pitch against the Cubs. He came off an amateur team, and he pitched tremendously for the Pirates. I really like this guy, or an independent team, I'm sorry. Holtzcombe is a threat to close games if Melancon falters, but I like Melancon a lot.
Yeah, I like him too. I've got him up at 7, so I think I'm pretty aggressive as far as what I'm willing to do to get Mark Melancon on my team. I've got Jonathan Papelbon at 9. Who did you have at 9?
That's where I have Cishek.
Okay, yeah, so we both got guys that are ranked within a few spots of each other at this point. I had Cody Allen at 8. You had Zach Britton at 8. 7 is the next spot up on our list. I've got Mark Melancon at 7. Who was in your 7th spot?
David Robertson, who is going to change the face of the White Sox along with a couple of other new guys. Now they're going to the 9th inning, knowing who's closing out the games, with terrific confidence in him. He had a high ERA pitching in New York. Don't let that worry you. He was over 3 at 3.08. He had a 1.06 whip. He improves in Chicago, not the short left field porch that he had in New York. Now he's got a short right field porch at Chicago. It's a tough place to pitch. He had 39 saves for the Yankees. He will equal that or better it with the White Sox. A much improved club.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, I think he's locked in. Plenty of job security when you have a $46 million contract in your back pocket. I've got Robertson at 6. That's where you had Fernando Rodney. So we're under our top 5. Kicking off my top 5, I have Dellin Betances. And I say that knowing that he has the tools to become the best closer in baseball. But for now, there's that little bit of uncertainty as far as whether the Yankees are actually going to go with Betances versus Andrew Miller. I'm pretty sure it's Baton says the thing you have to do, scale back his workload from last year because he probably won't see as many multi-inning appearances if he is going to be used as a traditional closer this year.
Derek, if he's the closer, and if he is the closer all year, I have him at 5, by the way, as do you. In fantasy, by 2016, at when we talk about this next year, this guy could be 1 or 2. That's how good he is. I mean, he's huge. He is a huge presence on the mound with a great fastball that he now can command. He can now control. You're talking huge strikeouts. This is a winner. And I like him closing out games for the Yankees. He worked with Robertson last year in the pen. Now I think he's going to have Miller setting up for him. Betances closing. This is a star in the making.
I completely agree with you. So that's not a surprise, given that we both have him at 5 and see the huge potential that Dellin Betances brings to the table. Moving up to number 4, I've got Kenley Jansen. Look at his 3-year averages, 32 saves, 13.4 strikeouts per 9, 2.5 walks per 9, 230 ERA, 0.94 whip over the last 3 years.
That's sick, isn't it?
That's just amazing. It feels like he's kind of underrated as the 4th-ranked closer, but they're 3 guys that I just like better.
And I have the same 3, and I have the same 5. Kenley Jansen's my 4. He could be number 1 on anybody's list. I mean, what else do you have to do to be the best closer in the game? Maybe do it longer? I don't know. Look at that strikeout rate. This guy is amazing. On a club that is going to win a ton of ball games, he had 44 saves. Do not hesitate. He is healthy. He is strong. I love this guy. Number 4.
Yeah, the best of the top 4 closers, he's on the best team, which if some people care a lot more about that than others, but
I mean,
that should – I think if you're trying to find a guy that could get 50 saves, you'd feel better about Jansen than even the 3 guys I've got ranked ahead of him. But Greg Holland's at 3 for me. You could make a case for him to be ranked the same as guys like Kimbrel and Chapman. I think the big difference is if Holland were to struggle, and I don't see any reason to think that he will, the Royals have a lot of bullpen depth. They have a ton of live arms they could turn to if they had to, whereas the other guys, Chapman and Kimbrel, are in bullpens that are much weaker. So that for me is the main reason why I've got Holland at 3.
Holland is also my 3. He's on automatic pilot. This guy just goes out there and does it game after game, effortlessly. He's got a 0.91 whip with 46 saves, a 1.44 ERA. I like everything about him in a great, not good, great bullpen, which was one of the reasons, in my estimation, that and the speed of the club that got the Royals to the World Series.
Final 2 spots. I've got Kimbrel at 2 and Chapman at 1, both on teams that are weaker than you would like, but weak teams still win games. They still create save chances. So I don't downgrade closers too much based on their team context. Kimbrel is at 2 because the walk rate last year ticked up a little bit. He's got a little more mileage on his arm, but again, you're splitting hairs. To me, they're almost more 1A and 1B.
I've got Chapman at 2, Kimbrel at 1, but let me talk about Chapman first of all. This is a guy who is, I believe, in his walk year, unless I'm mistaken. If not, he's close to it. He is going to pitch his heart out for the Reds. He's not going to have the number of save opportunities that a Holland will have, for example, or a Jansen will have, for example, but he's going to convert them. He's got that 101-mile-an-hour fastball. If he throws his slider, he's going to have guys' knees buckling. Just a terrific pitcher. And, oh, by the way, he throws with his left hand. I mean, that's quite a combination. And I've got Kimbrel at 1. Until somebody is better than him, I just don't see it. 47 saves last year, a 0.91 whip, a 1.61 ERA, but he's on a much worse team this year that is not going to score as many runs for him. I just don't know how they're scoring runs, DVR. I might be nuts. I have tried to figure this out. I see no home runs. I see a lot of strikeouts. I worry about the Braves' offense.
Yeah, they've got some issues, to put it nicely. Bernie, real quick, we're going to run through a few non-closer targets. We're going to save some toss-ups for next week. We already kind of ran over the usual duration here, but I've got a handful of names I want to throw out there. You can kind of give a quick response as to whether or not you're targeting these non-closers because of the potential they bring if they end up finishing out games for their respective teams at some point this year. Number one on my list is Ken Giles. I think he's number one on everybody's list right now in terms of non-closer relievers.
Yeah, no doubt about it. He made my top 40. He will be the Phillies closer if Papelbon goes, and then his stock just soars. We may know by the time spring training is over where Giles is working. I saw him in the Arizona Fall League, and I was all over him. The guy can throw bullets up there. He's that good. Look for Giles to get a closer job within 2 years for sure, and keep him in your keeper league because he's that good.
Yeah, he's going to be good for a very long time. The next guy on my list is Joaquin Soria. I just think if Joe Nathan struggles again, Soria has that experience. I think last year with the Tigers, he obviously had that oblique injury. I still think he has top 10 closer potential if he's tasked with that role.
Yeah, I've got him at 40 on my list only because he isn't a closer and he's a very good setup man. I think he may move down a peg to the seventh inning. I'm a little bit worried about what happens in Detroit. I'm not sure they have a lot of faith in Soria or in their closer right now, Joe Nathan. So my jury is out. That's why I had him only at 40.
I also like Kevin Quackenbush. I mean, we don't know for sure how the Padres are going to handle the ninth inning, even though I do think Benoit is probably the guy. There's that possibility that Benoit breaks down. Advanced age is a concern. Also possible that they trade a bullpen arm and Benoit could be that guy. Is Kevin Quackenbush someone you're interested in after he filled in pretty well last year for Benoit?
I saw him in the Arizona Fall League. He's on my bubble. I put him on my bubble list on MLB.com. Quackenbush is a closer in waiting, if not with San Diego. He could be trade bait. He could get the job. He's that close. He's a closer in waiting and a good one.
Wade Davis also made my list, only a little further down, not because of skills, but because the guy in front of him, Greg Holland, is so good. But if Holland were to get hurt, Davis could take the ball in the ninth inning, and you wouldn't notice a difference in terms of having a guy that could get you 90 or 100 strikeouts.
He's in my top 40, but I'm going to throw a caution light here. You know, Wade Davis, when he pitched for the Rays, didn't pitch anything like this. Of course, he was a starter there. And Wade Davis has pitched very well for Kansas City. Relievers have a tendency to be up and down, maybe a year, maybe two, and then I'm not sure Davis isn't a candidate to have an off year. I'm not saying he will. He's in my top 40. I forgot where I ranked him. But let me just say that I like Davis. I'm not sure he's a closer if, in fact, something happens. I'm not convinced.
Digging a little deeper, Jeremy Jeffers is a name that I think he's still interesting because Jonathan Broxton, to me, I don't think he's holding up all year in that role. If the Brewers don't bring in any other veterans, I think Jeffers has a shot to take that role over.
If Jeffers goes to the mound with a GPS, that's a possibility because I don't think he can find home plate. This is a guy whose arm I have loved. Is it GPS? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a GPS, yeah.
You know I'm a high-tech guy, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, this guy has such a tremendous arm. Whenever I saw him in the Fall League or in spring training, I'd sit at the edge of my seat and I'd say, come on, please, throw strikes. He can't do it. He has not done it in his career, Derek. If he threw strikes, he's a closer, clearly. And how long has he kicked around? I'm very surprised he's on your list, but it's an interesting call. It really is. I have to give you credit. I never thought of him because I wrote him off.
29 appearances for Milwaukee last year after returning to the organization that drafted him. He walked 7 batters in 28 and two-thirds innings. I mean, he seemed like he put it all together last year.
Wow. Good call, Derek. I mean, I'm going to watch him. I hope he has found it. And maybe I'll keep the GPS because I need one. You know, I'm not giving it to him.
The stuff has always been good, though, as you said. It's just a matter of locating. If he's turned the corner, he could be great. 3 more names I want to throw out there. RJ Alvarez in Oakland, more of a long shot, but this guy's had dominant numbers in the minors. And look, what if Tyler Clippard gets cast into the Lou Gregerson role? What if that happens?
How the hell did they get this guy? He is a very good pitcher that nobody ever heard about. I wrote about him when it happened. This is a guy to watch, folks. I'm telling you, he can pitch. With Clippard, they have a good back end of the of the bullpen. I'm not sure Doolittle comes back that quickly, Derek. I worry about him. And if he, even if he does come back, those two guys can really pitch. He may never close again. I'm not targeting Doolittle high. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm kind of tepid on Doolittle given the nature of that injury. And Oakland has a ton of viable alternatives, but Alvarez is a guy whose name you might not be that familiar with, but he has outstanding stuff and could come in and actually surprise. The last two guys, Brad Brock, I think I've liked him more than most people for a long time. The main reason is that if the Orioles were to lose Zach Britton to an injury or if Britton were to struggle, I think we've seen enough from them as far as their willingness to pass over Darren O'Day to know that Darren O'Day is not the closer in waiting in Baltimore.
Right. Brock was with the Padres when I saw him, I believe.
Yep, he was a Padre guy. Yep.
Yeah, I was not nuts about him, and my jury is still out. I don't want to say I've written him off. That could be a nice call from you because O'Day has been passed over, but I don't think you're going to have to worry about them finding another closer unless he gets hurt.
Yeah.
But Brock is not on my list.
No. Probably won't happen, but more of an AL-only target. Last guy on my list is a potential non-closer target, Kouji Fujikawa. Didn't really get a chance to show what he could do during his time in Chicago. His first season was cut short by Tommy John surgery, and he spent most of his second year in the big leagues recovering from Tommy John. The strikeout-to-walk ratio has actually been pretty good. I don't think you can buy a whole lot into the ERA we've seen so far. If Feliz goes down, I think Fujikawa might have the inside track over Sheppers to take over the ninth inning.
See, and I still think it's going to be Sheppers because of the stuff, but I can see why you would think that, and I'm not going to argue with that. I think it's a nice call. But I like Tanner Sheppers as a very good power pitcher. And if he's healthy, again, he's another guy that had some health issues. If he's healthy, I like Sheppers in the eighth and ninth innings.
That's going to wrap up our conversation for relief pitcher rankings here for this week. You can check out Bernie's piece at MLB.com. My post, again, it's in the Monday Round Tripper blog, rotowire.com/blog. Bernie, before we sign off, what's coming up at Pipeline at MLB.com and at Bernie's Baseball World?
On the cusp, posted today, New York Mets. On the cusp, posted today, Pittsburgh Pirates. These are players who I think may make it to the big league roster at some point in 2015. I hope you'll check that out. I hope you'll check out my blog at Bernie's Baseball World, bernieplescoff.mlblogs.com. I'm going over all the unfinished business for every club. Thanks again for being with us, folks. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Derek. Have a great week. What is on your agenda?
Well, it's been a busy week of blogging for me, also at the new RotoWire blog, but Wheelhouse column should be coming out on Friday, so be sure to check that out at RotoWire, rotowire.com/pod, P-O-D. If you are not currently a subscriber, you can get a free 10-day trial, check out all of our content, all of our projections, draft kit articles, those have all been rolling out, so there's tons of content to look at there. Thanks for listening to Short Hops. You can follow Bernie on Twitter, at Bernie Pleskoff. You can follow me, at Derek Van Riper. You can follow our podcast, at Short Hops. Anytime we have a schedule change or anything else on our minds, you can definitely get a hold of us that way. Views and opinions of Short Hops, those of Derek and Bernie and no other entity. If you want to sponsor this podcast, please contact Shannon at rotowire.com. Bernie, it's been a pleasure as always. Look forward to doing it again next week.
Talk to you next week, DVR. Have a great week. Bye. And thanks again, everybody.
Yep, take care.